Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen. So you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcast. That's gotomeeting.com/podcast for a free trial.
Ford is raising their prices again for the third time this year. Economics in the United States look absolutely horrendous. And there is a sector rotation that's in full swing. All this and Jack Schwager, author of Market Wizards, on episode number 214 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, thanks for joining me. Andrew Horowitz here. And I'm your host, of course, for the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And we are in the final days of May. And the adage of sell in May and go away has been well fulfilled and does, in fact, provide a good backdrop. You know, one of the things I noticed before May started was there was all these articles that were coming out that said something like, sell in May and go away. I don't think so. Here are the stats. You know, and I remember last year, the whole idea of, oh my gosh, sell away and go away was a real concern. But meanwhile, the markets went up. Kind of shows you the contrarian nature of much of the news headlines and maybe how to actually approach some of that. Because if you would actually go along with how the herd mentality thinks, sometimes it works out. But sometimes you gotta pick your areas that you really want to follow, and because you don't want to follow them over a cliff either, right? I mean, so I think that's an important thing to try to differentiate. It's not always easy. One of the things that we're seeing is the continuation of the story about the commodity boom is causing a lot of increases in prices in raw materials. One of the things that we know is that we're seeing the back end of this quarterly earnings is showing a lot more discussion about the problems associated with higher commodity prices. The problems that we're seeing with the margins of companies and their outlook. And it's been kind of hit or miss. There's been companies that have done really well and been able to hold up. And then there's a lot of other companies that said, you know, we're really concerned about this. You know, you could say that the ones that are concerned are just kind of trying to blame it on something. But the fact is that we're seeing restaurants and automobile manufacturers and chemical companies all increasing prices. And the reality is that due to the fact of either exported or homegrown inflation around the world, because we have such a globalized economy, the inflationary factors that they're seeing were going to eventually hurt us here, no matter how much the Fed continues to show that we have no inflation. So when we look at this and we kind of try to venture out what is going to be the overall effect of this on markets, on our investments, on our, you know, the interest rates and all that, you know, realize that at this point right now, we're still sticking with a potential longer-term stagflation concept where we do have inflationary considerations, inclusive of energy, inclusive of food and others, on top of a very high unemployment rate. And when you combine that, what you have is kind of a market that may move and companies that may do well, but at the same time, a consumer that really feels the pinch. And now when we look at much of the companies, I think this is really a fascinating distinction. When you see many of the companies that are reporting, there's a very, very, a demarcation point that we're seeing on one side. The companies that are in the high end, you know, you look at things like all of the Louis Vuitton and Gucci and Burberry. And you also look at Fossil, and you look at things like Tiffany. These are the high-end or the higher-priced companies with the higher-priced products, and they're doing very well. As a matter of fact, their outlook has almost never been better. On the other hand, we have the opposite side of the spectrum, which are, I guess, probably we'd say the dollar stores. I mean, how much cheaper can you get? Looking at the dollar stores, you have to look, wow, they're doing great too. Their outlook is great. But the problem comes somewhere in between there. You look at companies like Aeropostale and many of the teenage clothing companies, they're having all sorts of problems with cotton prices. You look at some of the restaurants are doing very well, but you know what? At the same time, they're doing well because they're really cutting expenses in a lot of areas, which I guess for a restaurant means service to you. Or maybe portions are being downsized, or maybe the food quality is being reduced. You know, you're seeing Sanderson Farms come out last week with just a horrendous, horrendous outlook. And the reason is because their grain prices and feed prices, I should say, are just, you know, off the top. And they just cannot put that back into the prices to the consumer because there's a point that consumers won't buy. And if you are in that middle section of companies where you're maybe necessities to a point, but yet discretionary, that's what's going to have the greatest squeeze first. Staples have done very well, at least from an aspect of the stock price and their earnings, because, you know, staples are a necessity and they're able to have a little bit more control over their pricing because you have to buy these things. Discretionary in the high end has done very well. And I think that's something that really is a testament to not the U.S. It's a testament to China and Asia, some of Latin America and around the world, especially those countries that are resource rich. They're going out and actually spending this money because they have so much more money in basic local terms and in dollar terms. With the dollar dropping almost on a daily basis, 0.5% here or there, with a down 15, 20, 30% against major securities around the world or major other currencies around the world over the last year, basically what you're getting is a high-end product fire sale. If maybe you were to buy a Tiffany product last year, and now this year you could buy the same product, even though they raised their prices, let's say for a 20% discount on the currency conversion, hey, that makes a lot of sense. So that's what's happening. The people with the disposable income can actually spend, and they have been doing so. Now, what's happening with Ford may be a little bit too much to bear, because not only is there the price component problem and the input pricing that they have, but remember something, there's also a historic problem when it comes to supplies. Japan took out a tremendous amount of the supply chain with obviously their tsunami, their earthquake disruptions. And let's just take a side trip just for a moment. Just humor me here. To the area of Fukushima, where the people who are in charge of the TEPCO nuclear reactors have been absolutely, unquestionably lying and getting away with it until just recently, when they said, oh, you know what? There are reactor cores that are exposed, and this whole area probably is not going to be inhabitable for a very, very long time. Much different than the way we said 2 months ago, and the government, whether it's their cover-up or they're just pointing the finger and showing that there was this situation where the disclosure of the information was not done, did exactly, if you remember, what we talked about right here on this podcast when it first happened. We said was, you know what, until, and I could probably pull the clip up, but until it gets to a point that they have no other choice, they will lie about the severity and hide the actual levels of contamination, because they have no, and when I say they, the government and TEPCO, have no incentive to do otherwise. If they were to give out the worst case scenario first, then that's it. If they could just slowly say it's bad, but not too bad, well, there won't be a panic. And that's what they were counting on. Because remember, we all have very, very short memories, it seems. Last week, The IMF said that, you know what, unless, well, it wasn't the IMF, it was actually one of the parties in the IMF, said unless Greece gets their act together, we're not going to give them any more money. Well, good for you guys. About 2 days later, the euro is back up to where it was because, you know, just everybody forgets that that's going to happen and maybe they'll change their plans. Maybe they'll change their minds. Anyway, getting back to the Ford situation. So they have a supply chain issue in Japan, and now they are raising prices because of input costs. But I was speaking to some people in the auto industry, and they are talking about a real problem here because they said, you know, think about it. If we built 10,000 cars and we need a speedometer needle for those 10,000 cars, and we buy that from a factory that can't produce them somehow because they're not up and running in Japan, we cannot put out those 10,000 cars. We can't put them out to the consumer. So what's happening now is there is a mad search on to find alternative suppliers. In the meantime, there's a major car shortage, and it's about to creep up even more. The major car shortage is going to create higher prices anyway, and what I'm also hearing is that the used car market is absolutely incredibly strong because of the shortage overall of new cars, and maybe you can use this to your advantage. When you're dealing with trade-ins, you can get a great sale price. Really incredible. So this is all coming at a time where economics are also starting to slow. I don't know if you've noticed, but this week we saw GDP for the U.S. revised for the second time. It was supposed to be somewhere in the 2.2 range, which of course was down from the 3-point-something range. And it came in at 1.8, very disappointing. Personal consumption was down on that in the GDP number. We also saw consumption down in the PCE numbers that we saw on Friday. And on top of that, we saw the initial claims over 400. We saw pending home sales just absolutely plunge 21% year-over-year differential. That's just terrible. Meanwhile, stock market keeps on cruising along. I will tell you that the economics this week was some of the worst that I've seen in a while in terms of trends. We saw that the CPI increased in Japan after 25 or 28 months of a deflationary spiral. All of a sudden, it's increasing. What a bad time for that. Obviously, because of the shortage of supplies, et cetera. But what a bad time for Japan to have an inflationary move higher. We're seeing that the manufacturing in China has slowed down. Singapore pretty much dropped off a cliff last quarter, or for the last period that was reported on Thursday. And, you know, I think that what we're seeing here is a general global slowdown that was not supposed to happen because none of the things vis-a-vis Europe or the Middle East issue, the heightened prices of oil or the Japanese earthquake were supposed to have any effect on the global growth story. That is the biggest bunch of crap I've ever heard. Whoever's trying to convince us that that's the case has got to really be crazy. Because if they had an estimate before all this happened of, let's just say, 3-4%, let's say 4% for global growth for 2011, don't you have to put some of these into the equation if they weren't there prior? So how is it possible that you're thinking that this is not going to have any effect, positive or negative? And I think this is just par for the course, that a lot of this blathering and rhetoric that goes on a daily basis has got to be just ignored and look at the overall trends as a more important factor. We hear on one day that Greece is not going to do anything with austerity measures because they just can't, they won't do it, and that's just flying right in the face of the IMF and the EU in terms of what they do need to do to get money. We hear that Portugal's not going to get money, and then they do. And I mean, it's just on and on and on and on. Good and bad both ways that knock things around for 10, 15 minutes, an hour, 2 days, whatever it is. The point is that earnings are good. They've come in pretty well in the quarter. In general, we've had about a 7% surprise on the S&P 500. A lot of that is due to the weakened dollar. Good amount is due to the fact that obviously it is a pickup in sales from the previous periods that were pretty bad. But now the question is, we look at margins. Are they going to compress? Are we going to see the same growth of earnings moving forward? Are we going to see EPS really as high as it was. Well, one of the things they did, as you know, that companies and the S&P has really rallied, and so has the NASDAQ and the Russell, and companies around the world have done very well at cutting expenses. And we've talked about this time and time again. It's all about human capital. This week, again, we heard that Ricoh, which is a Japanese firm, electronics firm, they rallied the most they had in months on the news that they're cutting 10,000 jobs. We've seen several companies in the last few weeks talk about pretty big cuts to the labor force. And that's why we're seeing the initial claims tick up again. So what's happening is we're going through almost a second, or maybe it's a third, or possibly even a final round of absolute cutting of jobs to make sure that the EPS and that the earnings hold up. And that is something that, obviously, as investors, we're good about. You know, we're happy about. But as economists, you have to say, wait a minute, how does this all play out? And that's where the stagflation discussion comes into play. So when we look about this, and look at this, and I think it's reasonable to then, you know, look at the fact that, well, yeah, the S&P 500 is under the 50-day, and it kind of has been moving and sliding lower. Russell 2000 is under its 50-day, under some support points. It's getting support on its 100-day moving average, and it's kind of in a funk right now. So I think, yes, there is agreement by investors that something is a little bit out of whack right now. The other thing I'll mention is, if you haven't noticed, some of the worst performing sectors in the world are the ones that you may not think are actually economically weak. Because the economics right now and the earnings combined with Fed actions on a country-by-country basis have to be aligned correctly for things to go well. And what we're seeing is, for the most part around the world, there is a general discussion of tightening and of restraining growth in many of the emerging markets. India, Brazil are two, China. On the other hand, Vietnam. On the other hand, you're seeing a questionable and tepid conversation about rate hikes in Europe, and that's really only due to inflation, not because of growth. And in the United States, it's, we're not doing anything. Well, you would probably think that a country like Brazil, which has an amazing growth of the middle class and is very active in world business, particularly when it comes to oil and commodities. Look at India, amazing amount of growth in the technology area, as well as, you know, growth of the economy from a from an emerging market to, you know, coming up to and developing. You would think that China, even though, you know, we've seen a couple little things here or there in the news, you know, generally speaking, China's doing really well. But you know what? Those countries, their stock markets are performing horribly. I think Brazil is down 14%, India is down 11%, China is down 6, 7, 8%. Why is that? Well, the major reason is that the Fed of their country, the government powers that be, have been talking continually and have been acting on a tightening measures. And those tightening measures are really creating a lot of problems, because when you have higher rates, or you have less availability of liquidity, or if you have desire to stop external flows from coming into the country, well, what you see is, in effect, a stock market that sells off. I mean, it's nothing more or nothing less than this saying, right? Don't fight the Fed. As long as you know where the Fed is. Right now, our Fed is kind of in between. We know that in China, in India, we know that in Brazil and many countries around the world, there's a lot of tightening going on, and we're seeing that those markets are rolling over. We see the countries that have either a no bias, let's say, which is probably, I would say, the U.S. right now, maybe some countries in Europe, to a weakening bias, which there really isn't anybody out there that's really flushing their economy with additional finances at this point. Although Japan could be put possibly in that camp, but they haven't acted on it. Those markets are actually doing fine, you know, generally speaking. So I think that you need to really perk up to not what has happened with the economics in terms of maybe jobs or maybe some of the other factors that are backward-looking, but more of the leading indicators and market action and what Fed speak is right now, because I think that's going to be the most important thing over the next six to 12 months. Will we see another QE, the QE 3, 4, 5? I don't know. But right now, the markets are looking very, very identical to what happened back the last time that QE was ending and the economy started rolling over. It's almost a very, I mean, it's fascinating how the economy, even though QE has not ended, is starting to slow so significantly. And we're seeing signs of slowing, whether it is inventory build, whether it is in the area of production, whether it is the various, whether it's Philly Fed or whether it's the Empire State, or these are all getting pretty ugly looking. And you're even seeing the weekly ECRI indicators actually showing a continuation of a slowdown. Now, I'm not saying whether it's going to be a 1 month, 2 month, 6 month, or another recession time. That's not the point. The point, though, is that it's pretty interesting, the timing on all this and how this is all playing out. Much of it, by the way, has to do with the fact that other countries around the world are actually trying to slow their economies, and the fact that Europe is a disaster, and the fact that oil prices have gone up dramatically due to the unrest in the Middle East. No wonder that people are flocking for gold, right? No wonder that commodities have been such a hot area to be in, because right now there's kind of this very strange involvement by governments that won't leave things alone, either on the helping side or the hurting side, either on by controlling and restraining or on the pumping into the economy and liquefying. The last thing I'll mention here is, and I'm going to mention that on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, we wrote about this on, I think it was Friday, the sector rotation that we're seeing. I talked about this on Frank Curzio's show as well. There was this dramatic move over the last number of weeks into healthcare, into telecom, into things like consumer staples, away from energy, away from materials, away from technology. And we're starting to see that change a little bit. Maybe that's month-end rotation, which we think it is, but there clearly is a defensive posture that is being put together right now by investors, whether it's the mutual funds, hedge funds, whatever it is. And you saw this move over the last 6 to 12 weeks very dramatically with a chart that we put up that shows the rotation and the movement, if you will, on a scatter chart on the Disciplined Investors. Just go over there after the show, check it out. Lots for you to see over there. Make sure to subscribe to it and get it in your RSS feeder. We talk about a lot of different areas when it comes to not only economics, but stocks as well on a regular basis. So anyway, lots to talk about there. Somebody mentioned that it was difficult to find, you know, how to contact us. I always tell you, ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Of course, go to the website. There's a little contact button there. You fill out a little form and it sends an email to us. Anything that you need to know, any question that you may have, I'm here for you. So just let me know. And I appreciate you know, all your comments that I got last week. All right, let's get to our guest. Now, as we had talked about, we have some great guests that have been on the last few weeks. But, you know, one of the things that you want to do when you talk about investing, you know, what is it? Well, you want to study two things. You want to study the paths and the successes of the masters. And probably you want to, at the same time, study the failures of the same people or those people that are no longer in the business. So I thought no better to bring on Jack Schwager, who is the author of the very popular, famous, and I would say, you know, one of those books you have to read if you're ever going to be serious about investing, called Market Wizards, New Market Wizards. And hopefully, Jack, you're going to share some of your wisdom with us, huh?
Hopefully.
So isn't that right, though? I mean, isn't the whole point of looking at the guidance, or at least the process, or at least the wisdom of those that are successful, is probably one of the better ways to start out at, you know, what should I do and what shouldn't I do, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you want to learn anything or try to learn anything, I mean, well, there are two good ways to do it. One is look at people who are doing it right, and the other is look at people doing it wrong and don't, you know, do something different. But probably the first one is a more direct approach. And the thing about, of course, training is that it is so individualistic. It doesn't mean that you try to copy what somebody else is doing, but you try to learn some of the basic principles, because there are certain universal principles that are true no matter how you approach the question of trading and investing.
Right. And, you know, so let's just go back for a second. And your first book, your first, no, let's go back further. The first interview you did for your first book was what year?
Back about, I think I did that book in 88, I think is when I actually would do any interviews. I think the book came out in 89.
And was that the days of, like, who were the names back then? There was Elaine Garrisella, well, right?
No. Actually, the people that I was interviewing were people that at the time were early on, but became sort of the famous, many of the famous hedge fund managers. So people like Paul Tudor Jones and Bruce Kovner and lesser known names, but people who were equally, if not more, as successful, such as Michael Marcus and Ed Sakota and others. So they were, I guess, in today's semantics, would be considered. Most of them were the type of traders that would be considered global macro type traders.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because the hedge funds of today, one of the big differences you have is that the hedge funds today, you have a lot. First of all, there's a lot more classifications, first of all, right? But also back then, wasn't it, you know, your kind of old-fashioned way of making, well, good or bad, but the old-fashioned way of making money, buying the right stocks and your thing. Now it's kind of like, you know, I went out and I bought these derivatives that I bet on the housing crash, and I'm doing this, and I'm actually looking at making an arbitrage on, shorting Japan but going long China, and at the same time, you know, moving into a cross-currency. It's a whole different thing, right?
Well, yeah, but in a sense, I mean, touch one, like arbitrage is a good word that you threw in there. The difference is, I mean, originally, most of the hedge funds were, well, very originally, the very original hedge funds sort of along the Jones model, which was a long-short type model, was, mostly net long, but longs and shorts to reduce the risk and picking the things that you thought would go up, picking the stocks you thought were better and selling the stocks you thought were weaker. Mm-hmm. And that's called the classic Jones model. That was the very first real hedge fund back in 49, and others followed that model. And then there was a second, and that kind of faded a bit, those type of funds receded a bit, which nowadays, by the way, they're called equity hedge funds. In the 70s, when the stock market became very difficult and people lost money, including Jones himself. And then there was like a renaissance of hedge funds sort of along the lines of Soros and people that I, Steinhardt and others. Again, a lot of people that I interviewed, although I didn't interview Soros. And those were the types of funds that were making the calls of, this currency is going to go up or this commodity is going down. It was that type of trading. It was directional global type trading.
Right.
And they became the dominant hedge funds of the time. And then as the hedge funds became more institutionalized in the 90s and 2000s, there were a lot more strategies became much more prevalent, and you had all sorts of arbitrages, like you had merger arbitrage and statistical arbitrage and convertible bond arbitrage. Mm-hmm. Like suddenly, convertible bond arbitrage didn't really exist. I don't think it even existed before the 1990s, although there were some guys who were doing it before then. But they became like major types of allocation strategies. So that was the big difference. You had these very, very narrowly defined specific strategies like convertible arbitrage, which became a type of strategy.
Right.
And now you have this whole range of strategies, including the traditional ones, which I just talked about, which was the equity hedge, which is now the largest component of hedge funds, and global macro, which was much bigger when I was doing Market Wizards and New Market Wizards, now is more. It's still an important strategy, but it's a much smaller part of the pie than it was then.
Well, one of the problems is with global macro, as the name would initially suggest, is there was an ability to look at the different components of the world and maybe look at the macro elements, look at the economics, look at the, look, for example, I mean, one of the first people I think I recall ever talking about this whole issue about globalization in Asia was Jim Rogers. I think that was one of the first, right? I remember.
And Jim was one of the people I interviewed in my original book, so he's a good example.
Yeah, so I remember that very distinctly. At the time, it was very fuzzy. What is he talking about, right? And then it kind of became very clear on how the whole emergence of the emerging markets and very simply would just have to eat and be clothed, and that itself is going to create an enormous amount of opportunity. And then, of course, with the movement to development of the countries. Now, At that time, though, the difference, as I see it, was that you could actually go and you could see the very distinct differences country by country in the economics and the opportunity. And fast forward from that point till now, we've become very homogenized in terms of the economics, where we're seeing almost a, I don't know, you know, if it's up over here, it's up over there. If it's down over here, it's down over there.
Yeah, you're quite right. I mean, that's one of the things that has happened over time is, yeah, the world has gotten much more globalized, and a consequence of that is that investments have become much more correlated, and even more so in recent years, where you've had periods of time where just everything goes in one direction. You know, it's sort of like you tell me what direction one market went, and I could tell you what direction every market went
right.
that day.
Right.
And it wasn't always that way. There was a time where you could be long metals and short grains, and long a currency one way or the other, and there was no implication. But now it's gotten into the cliche of risk on, risk off, and it's all, everything seems to kind of go up or down together, to a great extent, and I think that's become much more prevalent in recent years, and it's probably a consequence of globalization, not only in its general framework, because the world is much more interconnected, but also because I think investments are sort of institutionalized to a greater extent.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody does the same thing. So,
well, one of the problems we have also is the advent of computers. And this is really a concern of mine, because I think that, and this is probably something that you talk about, there's got to be a high degree of frustration with you answer the question. Is there a high degree of frustration with many of the traditional players out there that are frustrated because they know there is the algorithms that are running on a constant basis that are looking for a zig one way and they'll zag you the other way, and that are so incredibly programmed that you look at a 100-day moving average or 50-day moving average and you have to react to that because you know the machines will.
Well, it's not so much the moving averages, because those are the old trend following
models. Right, just an example. And that's been
there for a long time. What's different in recent years is a lot of money trading on really micro moves. And I guess the closest traditional hedge fund strategy to it is basically statistical arbitrage. But this is kind of statistical arbitrage in a more intense and
on steroids
on steroids in a minute way. So basically, the programs are kind of figuring out bids and asks based on a lot of inputs on everything, it's like you took the old market maker, you see the floor used to kind of do this and make a provide a bid, provide an offer, and kind of have a bit of ask spread and make the market that way, and kind of make human decisions along the way. Now it's done instantaneously, and it's done by in very large size by all these computer programs. So that's caused a change, certainly. One thing is, of course, they're pulling money out of the markets, but again, market makers are pulling money out of the markets as well. I don't know what the relative size between the two are. But it also does provide, it provides liquidity most times, but I guess as the flash crash shows, it can
but before they were there, there was plenty of liquidity. So that whole argument, I think, is really bogus. I got to be honest with you. I just think the whole argument of these guys providing liquidity is the only leg they can stand on for just milking. You know, I'd rather them to stay on the sidelines and let's pay a tax to them and be done with it. You know, just if you know.
Well,
the other thing is, though, you know what? If you were to actually put a zero bid ask, in other words, zero spread for any algorithmic traders and all that, they would stop doing what they're doing, because then they'll have risk.
Well, no, it's a computerization of market making is what it really is. I mean, that's what's really going on, and it does provide. When I say liquidity, what I mean is, of course, there's more trading, but that's not so much the point. The point is the bid-ask spreads are narrower, particularly on things that are
right.
less. You know, if you're trading some options on stocks and
right.
those things would be, they're still wide in many cases,
mm-hmm.
but they would be even wider. If this, one of the things that, one reason why you can do, why you can go in and buy or sell an option on individual stocks is because those programs are there making a market, you know.
Right.
So otherwise you could do it, but the spreads would be really, really wide.
I hear you. Yeah.
So there is an advantage there. I don't, you know, it changes the way markets work some way, but markets are always changing anyway.
Right.
And one of the things about really good traders is they adapt. You know, I'll give you a good example here. In fact, this is, as I mentioned to you right before we got on the air here, that I'm working on another Market Wizards book.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I'm not going to mention names at this point, but there's one trader that I interviewed, interesting in many ways. One because he breaks all the rules and is kind of totally different than anybody ever saw. But he's also been very consistent. Like, you know, since he started out 15 years ago, he's been making six figures consistently, you know, for a prop firm, always making money. And he trades in a very unconventional way. He's very much trading against. He really, I'll give you an example. I mean, the type of trading he does, if you remember when cotton was making its high of the move,
mm-hmm.
he was in there selling on the last 2 days of the high, I mean,
mm-hmm.
into the straight vertical uptrend.
Mm-hmm.
That's the type of trading he'll do. So it's very, very... It's very atypical, and it's not the type of thing I would recommend for hardly anybody, because it's very difficult to get away with that.
No kidding.
But he makes it work because he's got some, so he's got some innate sense. But the thing is, one of the things he also does is when he goes against the trend because he thinks it's getting way overdone, he'll be trading in and out of position day in, day out, and he's constantly making money because he may be short, the market comes down, he buys some back, then it goes up again, he sells it back again. So even though he's, you know, I've been told by people who work with him and know him and that I know well that you know he can make money. He's on the wrong side of the trend. He's still making money just because of his in and out trading is so good. But he was telling me, like, one of the things was he had a problem was over in recent years, especially beginning around the say 2003, well, you know, later 2004, 2005, hedge funds were becoming such a big influence, and their trading was different than the trading he had been used to all those years, because markets would bounce around more. But now hedge funds kind of took a position, they kind of stayed with it, and you
mm-hmm.
wouldn't get that much intraday volatility. So the market would be going up, it'd be going up the whole day, and there wasn't as much back and forth movement that gave him this opportunity. So he adjusted. He adjusted, he would wait longer before he put on a position, because he knew he'd have less opportunity to trade around the position. So
yeah.
he modified his approach for the changing reality of the market.
Right.
And that is kind of a good example, even though what he does is not something that would work for almost anyone
right.
else.
Right.
But what does that illustrate? It illustrates he has the flexibility to change his approach for the changing market.
Right.
And that flexibility is, in fact, flexibility is why I list
right.
you know, items that are important. That's one.
Let me share something with you. It's interesting because I know that over the last you know, dozen years that there have been several different and very distinct and very identifiable times that I was very clear about something. You know, you're not always clear about things, right? But sometimes you get
right.
this clarity moment. And, you know, there was the internet bubble and there was some kind of fuzziness there, but there was some clarity about really what you know was right. But okay. There was the housing issue, and I was screaming about it 2 years before it happened. And there was a few other things. Silver recently, about 2 weeks before it crashed, I put out a piece that said it's time to short silver. And I got to tell you something. Now, here's the point. Not that I want any, you know. But here's the point. One of the things that I've learned over the years is that the hysteria, the move, will go on much longer than I think. And when I think it's time, it's over. You have to wait a longer period of time, you know, and there's like
yeah.
3 points that I have to wait for whatever it is to turn, whether it's to turn up or to turn down, let's call it. Okay. And that doesn't mean trying to call tops or bottoms, but when you think that something is overdone and you see something clear, it's almost like the European situation. We saw this, you saw this, everybody saw this a year ago. Well, you know, you figure, all right, now it's bad timing. Well, you got to wait a little bit longer because it just takes a lot longer to get through whatever it's going to go through till it actually everybody figures out, you know what? There's something wrong. And that's that whole point of adapting to the move. And I agree that's something that's very, I think it's important for people to learn that, you know, maybe whether it's patience or, by the way, in the future, it may turn around the other way around, right? Things may happen a lot quicker in a different market condition.
Yeah, things can always change, yeah. And so it's a matter of being able to adjust for different market
yeah.
Conditions.
So here's what I want to ask you. I know you have these books coming out, and there's a lot of people that you'll be you know, putting together the interviews with. But if you were to have one person that you could interview for the, we'll call it the dead market wizards, not to be disgusting, but the dead market wizards, somebody that's not alive today that you hadn't had a chance to talk to in the past?
I don't know. Someone's not alive.
Not alive. Because then if they're alive today, you can interview them. So they're not alive.
Not always.
True. Right. Well, not breathing. Okay. Who do you think it would be? I mean, somebody back from. Benjamin Graham. I mean, would it be somebody as you know basic as that, or you know?
A lot of the greats are still. Alive. Most of them, so people like Soros, whatever, they're still, so people, the age of trading, sort of, the way we think of it, it really became more prominent, I suppose, in the 60s, 70s,
right.
At the earliest point. So those people, for the most part, are still around.
All right, I got you. Well, I'm sure Livermore is on your list, right?
Well, he would be interesting. He would be interesting, although in many ways, Livermore would fail the test that I, would fail in conditions that I
right.
use for including in the book, because he had a lot of great runs and, kind of blew out like three times and as you all know, ended up committing suicide at the end.
Right, he was a gambler. He really was a gambler, but at the bottom line, rather than a real...
But the book that was written about him is reminiscence of a stock operator, reflects an enormous amount of wisdom, and I suspect that had he followed the advice in that book, he would not have blown out three times, and he would not have ended up committing suicide. I think he must have disregarded his own advice.
Yeah.
But Livermore would be interesting because insofar as he was the prototype for the book, and there's so much good information in there, and there's certainly a lot of good stories. I guess, that would probably be an interesting one.
Mm-hmm. So I don't think that it would be fair to have you for this time and not ask you an obvious question, and that is, do hedge funds have an? I mean, especially with what's going on in the news with Rajaraman, where I can't pronounce. Somehow have an unfair advantage? SAC, Steve Cohen is being questioned, and some other things that are being accused of. I mean, do they have an unfair advantage? And the way they're making money is really something much more simple than just being really great at what they do, but rather being subversive and breaking the rules and not playing fairly.
Okay, interesting question. Okay, so here's my take. My take is. That the reason hedge funds perhaps are not as great as they may seem on the surface in terms of performance and so forth, not because of the reason you're and I'll get back to that you're indicating, because they have got inside information, unfair advantage, or are basically cheating at the game. It's something else, actually. It's a little more subtle. It's that they take certain risks. Except maybe larger risks. So a lot of times you'll get hedge funds that do well because they're taking a lot of risk, and that risk becomes evident in the year like 2008. The risk is usually of the type of the liquidity.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times the returns may not come from schemes. That's one of the points I make I mentioned to you the other book I was working on about misconceptions. Mm-hmm. People have markets. But one of the things that people don't understand, they pay so much attention looking at returns and all that, but they fail to understand that a lot of times, a lot of what is returned is not coming from skill, it's coming from beta, of taking market risk, and if you take more beta than the market, you should make more return than the market.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you're particularly smart, right? So, I can put together a stock portfolio that's sort of similar to the S&P, but I margin at 50%, and if you get an up period in the S&P, I'll be doing twice as good. It doesn't make me particularly smart. It just means I'm willing to take twice as much risk. And so what you get, and that's a very simple example, but what you get in the hedge fund world is people take risk either through, the larger exposure, but more usually it'll be things like taking illiquidity risk. So there's built-in, the market will pay premium for you to take illiquid positions, And in times where we have long risk on, such we had a long sequence of between 2003 to some point in 2008 where that was true, the market, you know, you'll do very well doing that type of trading, but you're taking on, you're the insurance company, you're mm-hmm. taking the risk if something goes wrong, you can't get out, but in the meantime you're collecting premiums. So I think the one reason, alluding to the question that you asked or answering that, is that where hedge fund performance may not be so much totally a matter of skill, is because a lot of it is not a matter of skill. A lot of it is just a matter of willing to take risk, and it's why you can't just judge who has the higher return as a way of judging who's the better manager. You have to really look return to risk, and risk is more than just volatility. It's also a matter of what the inherent risk in the positions are.
Right.
So that's one element of it. And I think the main element. Now, the point you raise about do hedge funds have an unfair advantage? Well, by their size, just by logic, and I don't know anything specific here any more than anybody else does. But by size, if you're big enough, and I suppose if you're not honest, you could probably have a better shot than you certainly have a better shot than the average guy of getting somebody to call you with some information. To what degree? Obviously, it goes on to some extent because you have the SEC bringing these suits. So there's got to be something. You assume presumably there's something there. But to what degree it goes on, I don't know.
Nor does the SEC.
I don't think it's the main element. I don't think it's the main element. And there's lots of hedge funds out there that are not doing things that require, you know, particular knowledge about what a stock's, you know, inside corporate information, that type of thing. A lot of, particularly if you think strategies like global macro or things of that nature, it's not an issue at all. So I think that on balance, hedge funds may not be as great performance-wise as the overall image may be.
Risk-adjusted performance. Let's clarify that.
Important. Exactly. So in terms of risk-adjusted performance, but I do think, but I will go this far, I do think as a group that they are certainly better than the traditional managers. And that's empirically true, but it's also just logically true, because if you pay people based on their performance and you pay another group of people, well, you know, you're going to get a salary, and as long as you kind of match the index pretty closely, your job is safe. And if you get to, you try to be a hero and get very smart, and if you do really well, we'll may give you a small bonus. And if you're off, well, we're going to fire you. So the group that has that second compensation package, which is basically they're incentivized not to move too far from the benchmark. You know, they're just by definition, you know, you're not going to get your best people in that group vis-a-vis a group that's being paid an incentive on their performance.
Yeah, so what you're describing, my friend, is very simply the difference between socialized investing and capitalistic investing. That's all it is.
Yeah, you could look at it that way. You know? Yeah, it's exactly. And in that sense, you know, the hedge funds do represent a more kind of free market capital, because the of course the mutual fund managers can do what they want in theory, but in practice, the structure of that whole investment area is such that the reality is managers are incentivized not to stray from the benchmark.
Yeah.
And that's what you get.
Yep. Hey, by the way, if you want to use that little snippet that I just made up for your book, I'll be happy to allow it. It's fine. It's okay to use it, okay? So just
you don't know royalties.
Well,
okay.
Yeah, no, it's no problem. It's no problem. The other thing is that what's the common thread with all of these players out there? You know, whether they're hedge fund managers or whether they're just traders, or what's the common thread that makes them successful? Aside, you know, what is it? Can you boil it down to one or two things?
Well, you know, no, I can't boil it down to one or two things. You know, you can talk about certain things that are critical, and it's a whole list of them. You know, I mentioned one before was flexibility, the ability to change. I mean, I think that's very critical. I mean, not to have an opinion that you're married to be able to turn on a dime when the facts dictate it. That's a common trait of people who are successful. If you're too invested, pun not intended, all intended, in your idea, that is a recipe for failure. So, the classic example, and I'll come back to some other points, but since I've gone back to flexibility, let me just finish it with one other example. Stan Druckenmiller, who I did interview for one of the prior books, and what I consider to be the greatest example I've ever come across about flexibility, he made what you would consider probably the worst mistake ever. He had been short the stock market on Friday, October 16th, 1987, and had decided the market had gone down enough and covered his entire position and actually went net long.
Ugh.
And I used to ask people, do you know anybody who ever made a worse mistake than that? I mean, it's just a horrible mistake. But the beauty of this story is that, yeah, and if you look at his record, he hardly lost any money in October 87, which is kind of hard to, how is that possible?
Right.
Because it's possible because what happened was, well, he was short the first half of the month, so he made money. But the thing is, over the weekend, he sort of came to the realization he had made a mistake. He was absolutely convinced he made a mistake. So he came in Monday morning. If you remember that Monday morning, you know, Dow Jones at the time was down like, opened like 200 points down, which was a huge move, of course, for the Dow at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the market opened up the equivalent of what maybe it ended up. I mean, we ended up down mid-20s or that day, but I think we opened down like 10% or whatever. So what he did is he not only covered his, you know, he not only covered the new long position he put on, you know, Friday, but then he went back short again. So, I mean, that to me is such an amazing example of being flexible, you know, and very, very few people would be able to do that, but that is, to me, is the epitome of a great trader, to be able to be that wrong and to turn on a dime like that, not only to cover your position, but to go the other way when you know you've been wrong.
Well, one other way twice, in other words. He went long, closed, and then shorted.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, yeah. So twice. I mean, but the first time, of course, was a mistake. But the
right.
point, the important point is the second time where he realized he made a mistake and switched back again.
Right.
And almost, you know, out of 10,000 traders, like one may be able to do something like that.
Right.
And so it's a rare, to have that skill to that level is rare, but it is one of the trademarks of really good traders.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of others. I mean, if you ask the traders themselves why they think they've done well or what's responsible for their success, one thing that almost all of them will tell you, and what you can see as well, is discipline. They are very disciplined in their approach. They're not, you know, I never interviewed a top trader who's kind of asking, you know, what he does, and he says, kind of wake up in the morning and
figure
out
what's
on the machine. and if bonds look good, I'll buy some bonds. And if I got a good feeling about the stocks, I'll buy stocks. It's never that cavalier sort of shoot them, which is the way a lot of people trade, you know. They have a specific approach. It's going to be
right.
very different. It may be very, very precise. It may be more general, but follow certain guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
But they've got a specific approach, and they
right.
follow it. And when they're wrong, they have a plan on what to do when they're wrong.
Well, that's the hardest thing, isn't it? Isn't that the? I mean, you're saying it again. It's the same thing again. It's to understand that you are not making you're making the decision, but you need to make the decision based on the facts that are in front of you, not on how you are either rationalizing what they are or maybe interpreting them incorrectly. It's just the facts are the facts, and just be, you know. I mean, this week was a great example of that. You know, you had almost everything that you wanted to throw at some of the markets, let's say on Wednesday and Thursday, and you had really horrible economic numbers, and frankly, the earnings weren't so good, to be honest, and GDP was yuck, and all of this, and the markets somehow, for some reason, just couldn't really go down. And in fact, a lot of stocks did some real great moves, and you scratching your head saying, all right, what am I missing here? But you know what you're missing, if you have to ask that question, I think, is what's right in front of you. That's what is happening. And until, you know, whatever it is that flushes out to show you the reason why, it is what it is.
Yeah, I mean, usually that's because of something else that's more important that's going on.
Right.
And it's not, you know, one of the big mistakes that people make is believing that markets move when they move because news has come out that day. And of course, you know, all the market media is of course tied to that model. And anytime the market's going to be up or down a lot, there'll be reasons why the market's up or down a lot. They'll give you reasons why it's up or down a lot. Those may or may not be the reasons.
Right.
And the curious thing is, of course, the market reverses the same reasons why the market was up. You'll end up being the reasons why it was down, just explained in a different way. I'm sure you've seen that a lot.
Oh, my gosh, the other day, this happens 2 days ago.
They said that the global markets were moving higher because commodity prices were higher, thereby cementing the fact that the global growth story is still intact. I'm thinking, what in the world does higher commodity prices have to do with the global growth story?
There's no news. They'll find something.
Right, exactly.
And find some way to make it, you know, so it's never, the news doesn't explain the price move, or it's the other way around. The price move necessitates a news story to fit it.
Right.
And so when you get, but to your point about when you're getting a lot of news coming out, and it sounds like, it's negative and the market is holding and going higher, well, that is probably there's probably a reason that's more important than those daily items that have come up, whatever that reason might be. You may or may not know it, but that's what it is. It's mm-hmm. not just by chance. And of course, that's not a bad indicator. Usually, if you're getting a lot of news that seems like the market should be down, and instead it goes up, then that's usually an indicator that. That the market, for whatever reason, wants to go higher. And
right.
It's not going down.
Yeah,
so
no,
it's not,
no, I hear you.
In fact, the way to use news, the way I would advise people to use news is exactly the opposite of the way to use it. It's not that bullish news comes out, so hence you should be bullish. It's if bullish news comes out and the market doesn't go up, that's bearish. You know, mm-hmm. it's only useful in a contrarian way.
Right.
That's the only way I could ever see
using yep.
it.
Well, it's the same thing with earnings. I mean, how many times have we seen an earnings reversal? You come out with a great number, and things look great, you're buying on the headline, and then somebody decided to read the actual report and see that, you know, they didn't use GAAP this time, and there was a one-time tax deal in the number that you're looking at, and, you know, and then all of a sudden you see the next day, you're like, what happened there? You know, what happened, you know, with that situation? You know, last night you went to sleep and it looked good, and you wake up in the morning. You know, again, this week was the same kind of thing. You know, you saw silver. Everybody was all excited about silver. And then all of a sudden, you go to sleep, you wake up in the morning, it's down 4%, and you know, that was only a few hours ago. It seemed like everybody
yeah,
was
Yeah, well, silver is a different thing. Silver is just, strictly, as you well know, it's just a psychological market.
Uh-huh.
There's no way, I mean, industrial usage for silver is just, you know,
right.
not the issue here.
Right.
It's strictly a roulette game now on people's expectations
yep.
of you know, what other people are going to do.
So yeah, you know what I think is really cool about silver? I think it's really cool. I was thinking about this just the other day. Silver, if you want to be bullish, you can make a bullish case on silver no matter what the circumstance. So in other words, if the world is
and no fall- matter what the price.
Right, no matter
what,
if the world
no
is
price,
falling
you know.
If the world is falling apart and if you know, currencies are going to just implode, silver is a great thing because you have a good currency, you know, you have a piece of brick that is actually backed by something, right? Now, and there's a few other things. If on the other hand, the earth and the world and the economies are fine, well, there's great use for industrial components for silver, and there's a great opportunity because a lot more of the metal will be used. I mean, you can almost become diluted with all of this, you know, going through your head. And if you want to make this case, it's kind of, I mean, listen, Peter Schiff does it great.
Fundamentals, yeah.
You know, so anyway, listen, Jack Schwager, we're running a little bit over time. I want to tell you something. New Market Wizards, the new Market Wizards. Of course, he can't say if I'm going to be included or not in that because we're not mentioning any names. And I can't say it either, by the way. So therefore, we can't say anything about that. But his new books are coming up. Of course, I'm not going to be it. I'm not a wizard yet. But you know what? He has some great books. I would encourage you to go check out the New Market Wizards and Market Wizards. Great information and a study of who the greats were and how to really understand their story because it's written in a conversational interview style, right? So
that's what it is.
That's
yeah.
what it is. All right, you know, we're going to give, we'll put some of the ways to, in fact, contact Jack and find out more about him on the podcast show notes. So check that out. Jack, hey, appreciate you coming by, and we'll do it again soon. I'm looking forward to your
sure.
books.
Okay, take right, care.
Thanks,
bye.
Bye-bye. All good things have to come to an end. I think that was a good episode, don't you? I think talking with Jack and understanding about what happens with regard to the mindset of traders, investors, the ones that are successful, the ones that you want to emulate, is always good study. Understanding what happens and sometimes changing your ways and adjusting. A great story that he mentioned about adjustments by an advisor when things were going quite wrong for him, I think I thought it was really interesting. Anyway, I want to thank you again. Of course, we're going to have some great guests lined up. I think we are trying to line up Doug Cass. he's kind of difficult to get a hold of. But we have him. We've been talking to Dennis Gartman. I want to bring back to talk about what's going on with the grains and the outlook after Russia put an export ban. But now they have removed the export ban just this weekend. And I want to also look for some of the people we had talked about and their predictions. You know, of course, we have Harry Dent, who was saying that we're going to have an all-out depression. And so far, so good. That hasn't really come true. But I do want to talk to him about what his updates are. I also want to bring back Terry Bedford. We've been talking with him quite often and talk about some directional moves. And, of course, we have to have some of the other people that I think that can bring a good sense of understanding with regard to markets. I spoke with Kate Stalter, who used to be with Investors Business Daily, now with TheStreet.com, just this week. And I think that she has some interesting insight as well. So lots going on. And of course, if you have any guests that you think would be a great person to interview, just email me. Just send me a note and I'll do my best. We'll try to figure out a way to get them and just send it to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Till next week, have a great week. It's a short week. Be action-packed. Don't forget that Friday is the big employment day. And of course, we have to be looking for what, if anything, Greece does to whatever they're going to do. I mean, what can they do? They could just say they're going to try really hard at this point and hopefully everybody believes them and we just kick the can down the road a little longer. Or maybe this is going to put the big finger up and say, you know what, IMF? Too bad. This is the deal. Either give us the money or we're going to default and pull out of the EU and then everybody's going to get crazy. So they're not going to do that. Gigantic game of chicken being played right now. Greek style. We'll see you soon. Thanks for joining me today on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.